50 years ago this week, when director Stanley Kubrick released 2001: A Space Odyssey, a lot of critics panned the movie, and many confused viewers walked out of theaters before it ended. 50 years later, the film is considered a masterpiece. It consistently ranks as one of the most influential movies of all time. Michael Benson takes us behind the scenes. He's the author of the new book, Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure.
Well, I want to take you back to 1968. 2001 comes out. A science fiction fan takes her six-year-old kid to see the movie, and that kid is you. Talk about what it was like seeing this movie as a six-year-old kid.
Yeah, my mom was an Arthur C. Clarke fan, read all his books, and when 2001 came out, she took me to see it. And I just remember being absolutely staggered, and not just staggered in the way a six-year-old is staggered about everything. I was really impressed by that film, and I think it was the first masterpiece in any genre that really spoke to me. And it was confusing, of course, and I think it was confusing to a lot of people. I think one reason that that film remains so salient, let's say, today, and so provocative today, is that it's a kind of masterpiece of ambiguity in a way. Now, I couldn't have articulated it that way at the time. I do remember following my mom down the sidewalk. It was a hot summer day. I think it was New York. And I was saying, but what did it mean? You know, and her response was, I don't know.
Yeah, the movie stuck with you. You stuck with the movie. You've got a new book out now. 50 years later, what is it about 2001 that makes it still worth talking about and watching?
Well, I mean, that film encompasses 4 million years of human evolution and, you know, seems to span most of known space. So it's pretty comprehensive. That's about as comprehensive as you can possibly get. It has multiple themes within it that are still salient today. One of them concerns artificial intelligence with HAL, the HAL 9000 computer. And by the way, I just wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times about exactly that, about HAL and current machine learning algorithms and manipulation due to AI.
Open the pod bay doors, HAL.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
Well, that's one place where 2001 remains relevant. But there are many others. I mean, you know, the larger questions concerning our destiny as a species and our place in the universe, I mean, that couldn't be, that's just kind of a perennially timely.
And you mentioned the author, Arthur C. Clarke. You talked to him for the writing of this book. I understand he had set out to make the first really good science fiction movie. Talk about what he was hoping to get out of this that hadn't been put on film in the science fiction genre.
Yeah, so I met Arthur in the year 2001, and it wasn't with the intention of writing a book about 2001. I had some other agenda, and we hit it off and became friends, and I visited him subsequently in Sri Lanka 3 more times. And it was actually Kubrick's line about doing the proverbial really good science fiction movie in his letter written to Clarke on March 31st, 1964, proposing that they meet and discuss that possibility. What did Clarke want out of it? Clarke wanted an big international deal. He had had a number of novels out, lots of short stories, and was intrigued. He was a little jealous, I think, that Robert Heinlein had written the script for Destination Moon 10 years before. And what did he want? He wanted a great collaboration that would lead to a superb film based on his ideas, and that's what he got.
When I think of movie making, I think probably incorrectly think, okay, you go in, you've got this script, you have a roadmap, you know what you're doing, and you know what the end point looks like. That was definitely not the case for 2001. This tale evolved in the production of the movie, right?
Yeah, that's another extraordinary thing about 2001. I mean, Kubrick had a budget comparable to a James Cameron budget today or Lucas or what have you. That is not usually a situation where you want to be improvising a lot and changing the story as you're shooting. But he did just that. Kubrick and Clarke were modifying the story throughout. There was never a fixed script. It was an R&D project on multiple levels, including the storyline, but also about technologies and how to convincingly portray spacecraft on screen and portray interstellar travel on screen, you know. They were inventing it all as they went along.
That's an important point you talk about a lot in the book. You know, if you think of older science fiction movies, there's the flashy ray guns and saucer-like flying ships. They really did, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the crew did as much as they could based on the technology at the time to make this look plausible, to design stuff that might conceivably work, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I got to know Tony Fruin, who was a young assistant to Kubrick at the time, you know, during the production in 2001. He said in one of his earliest conversations with Kubrick, they had a long talk. At one point, they were discussing science fiction, and Kubrick said, "Cinema has let science fiction down." And what he meant was there was so much good science fiction published, you know, before 64, 65. But film had not risen to the occasion in his view. There had been as you said, all those ray gun films, Flash Gordon, low budget, you know. But Kubrick wanted to really kick it upstairs, and I think he succeeded.
And in making this technology real, they kind of had to invent stuff. And I guess there were a lot of problems with things like spacesuits with limited amounts of oxygen and centrifuges that blew up lights and things like that. Can you talk about some of the technological hazards that went into making this movie?
So the centrifuge set was 38 feet wide and many tons. And had a, you know, it was motorized to turn. It was like a hamster wheel. And film lights don't really like to go upside down, and they had hundreds of them on the thing. And, you know, when they spun it, you know, frequently bulbs would blow up and shower glass down, and it was a hazardous environment. It was a really hazardous environment. As for the spacesuits being hermetically sealed, now that's a story. Stuntman Bill Weston's heroic performance hanging above the studio floor, 30 feet above the studio floor with no net and one of those spacesuits hermetically sealed. So he did have an oxygen bottle, a very small oxygen bottle inserted in the back, you know, in the backpack of the spacesuit. But there was no way for the carbon dioxide to escape the suit. So there's a whole story that I tell in the book, you know, about Weston going to Kubrick and saying, you know, "Stanley, I'd like to punch some holes in the back of the helmet so I can get some fresh air." And Kubrick refused because he was afraid there would be light leaking in those holes. And okay, so I'm not going to get into all the detail now, but the upshot is that one of the first times that Weston was hanging up there, he went unconscious from the carbon dioxide poisoning. He did that after the crew below said, "We have to bring Bill in. You know, he's signaling to us he needs to come in." And Weston heard Kubrick saying, no, "I didn't get the shot yet. Leave him up there." So when Weston came to, and by the way, Bill Weston had been a mercenary in South Africa. He was not somebody you wanted to mess with. Weston was furious when he came to, and he went up to find Kubrick to teach him a lesson, basically. And Kubrick had fled the studio and didn't come back for 3 days.
"Without your space helmet, Dave, you're going to find that rather difficult."
Now, the movie comes out, you saw it and were confused but blown away by it. A lot of critics, Roger Ebert, some science fiction authors, I think Ray Bradbury, didn't like this movie. They thought in that vast scale you mentioned earlier, the human element was lost. Talk about some of the reception then and how it's changed.
So there was an initial perception that the film was cold and inhuman and that this was a mistake. Now, there were... everything Kubrick did was intentional, basically, not to, you know, I didn't write a hagiography and he had his fault. But the portrayal of human beings as essentially component parts of their technology was very willful and conscious. And he was saying something about our relationship to technology and how technology was also changing us. And so people didn't really get it. The older generation of critics, most of them didn't get it. So, for example, Andrew Saris wrote in The Village Voice that 2001 was a thoroughly uninteresting failure and the most damning demonstration yet of Stanley Kubrick's inability to tell a story coherently and with a consistent point of view. So these were slams. Those are very personal kind of slams, and there was a lot of that in the opening week of the film. But the younger generation lined up to see that film, and later on, Kubrick said a teenager saved his film. There was no problem with younger people who were younger understanding what Kubrick was getting at. You know, the entire counterculture embraced that film. It was kind of a piece with some of the radical, cultural, experimental, avant-garde innovations going on in the 60s. So they got it. The older generation didn't. And it was, you know, this is 68 we're talking. So it was really that generational divide at work.
And Michael, there's a new generation out there that may not have seen this movie. Can you make the case for those teenagers, 20-somethings today, to go out and stream or rent or however they see the movie now?
Well, by the way, Warner's is going to re-release it this year, so they should go see it on a big screen. And they
absolutely
should, because, you know, that film, it's extraordinary that so much of it has not dated. It's still futuristic today. You know, we don't have an AI, general intelligence, artificial general intelligence is the term used in computer science, like HAL 9000. You know, we don't have some of the technologies that you can see in the film. But that's not the reason to go see it. The reason to see it is the grand vision of our position in the universe. That's just timeless, you know. And I predict that film is going to still be discussed and analyzed and studied, you know, for hundreds of years in the future. I think it's one of those keepers from the 20th century.
It's a good place to leave it, Michael. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks. It was really a pleasure. I appreciate it.
That was Michael Benson, author of the new book, Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece. At this time next Friday, we'll talk about the music and sound used in the film to illustrate the loneliness of space travel and just how big the universe is.